week, we're continuing now with our study of the Rambam in Hilchos Rotzeach. It's interesting how he puts together two different areas. Hilchos Rotzeach, laws of... It doesn't say Ritzicha, interestingly enough. You'd have thought laws of murder. Rotzeach is the murderer. And Ushmiras HaNefesh, and protection of life. What's the combination? What's the juxtaposition? Well, these are two separate things. Obviously, one can intersect with the other, because if you're interested in saving your life, you should try and avoid murderers, that's for sure. But from the conceptual standpoint, it's very interesting that he chooses to bring together two sets of, I mean, the laws that pertain to protection, Shmiras HaNefesh. It's not only, it's true, I mean, virtually anything. I mean, war can also be part of that. It's related to many, many things. Plagues, it's related to floods, it's related to war, it's related to many things. So it's related to murder too. But I don't see the direct connection, such a essential connection. But we'll see. We also pointed out that there's many mitzvos in the area. So it's an all-encompassing issue. This Shabbos, the Aseres HaDibros, so we had a discussion. And what exactly are the Aseres HaDibros? What's the Aseres HaDibros? Well, first of all, I made a new proposal that we should not ever refer to it as the Ten Commandments, because that's a mistake. It's not the Ten Commandments. What is it? How would you refer to it? Commandments, mitzvahs, commandment. And in these ten so-called commandments, there's many more mitzvahs than ten. For example, the first one is belief in Hashem and negation of idolatry. It's the second one is negation of idolatry. But there's many mitzvahs. You can't fashion an idol. You can't. That's one thing. Even if you don't worship it, you can't bow down to an idol. Even if you don't own it, and so forth. There's a number in the Aseres HaDibros themselves. There's more than ten mitzvahs, if you're going to count in terms of mitzvahs. So, and that's not the term. It's a misnomer. What then should it be called? I wonder why people call it the Ten Commandments. Why do people refer to it as the Ten Commandments? I'm not sure, but I think that the idea of the Ten Commandments is something which has the universal significance. It's interesting. It's not limited just to Jews. That is to say, there are many people that hold from the Ten. For some reason, it assumes a place of special importance in people's eyes. That's not such a simple thing. That's why, really, we don't stand up for the reading of the Aseres HaDibros. Because the Gemara mentioned that there was a sect that maintained that only the Aseres HaDibros was from Sinai. As the Torah describes it, that's what the Jews heard at Sinai, was the Ten Commandments. That's the Aseres HaDibros, I'm sorry, I keep saying it. But, of course, you know, that was just the introduction, that was just the beginning. The purpose of that was so that the Jews should have a direct encounter with Hashem, that they should hear from Hashem, that Hashem is the author of the Torah, and at the same time, v'gam b'cha, that God designates Moshe Rabbeinu, that Moshe Rabbeinu is the authentic spokesman to transmit the Torah to the Jews. But there are many people that look at the Aseres HaDibros as being different and unique. For example, there are Gentiles. Years ago, and I think it was the Johnny Carson show, we were talking to some individual about that, I don't know how the subject came up, whether the person's religious. I keep the Ten Commandments. He's not Jewish at all. The truth of the matter is he doesn't keep the Ten Commandments. People like to say they don't keep the Ten Commandments, because one of the Ten Commandments is Shabbos. So what people have in mind when they talk about the Ten Commandments, they mean a certain general ideas of morality. Thou shalt not kill, that's what it is. I'm not a killer. I keep the Ten Commandments. I don't kill. I don't go around killing people, so I keep the Ten Commandments. And what about bearing false testimony? Oh, I don't go in court. But that's not, but maybe you do. See, if a person says, well, I never lied in court. I never was a false witness. So therefore, insofar as that's concerned, I keep the Ten Commandments. Would you agree? That's a good question. Let's say it's true that the person never ever, he was in court a few times, he took the oath, he always spoke the truth. So he was cognizant of the Ten Commandments. I'll use that word for the time being before I tell you the new word. Is it true? No. And this will help us to understand what this... Okay. That he didn't keep. I don't know that he kept it yet, even if he ascertains that. Because what about... Let me check your income tax returns. Did you always tell the truth on your income tax returns? If not, or other forms and so on and so forth. That's also included. See, people think that the Aseret HaDibros is just thou shalt not kill. Thou shalt not kill.
No, well, they think the Ten Commandments.
See, but then they don't, you don't understand what the Aseret HaDibros, what is the Aseret HaDibros? So why are these, is it just 10 mitzvahs? So there's 613 mitzvahs. So what's so special about these?
Like just a guideline or
an these are all the 613. These are the headings. These are the major headings. And one of the fellows asked me, what's the difference between this and the Rambam's 13 Ikarim, the 13 foundations?
Well, that's why I'm
maintaining that when people in general, people that don't keep the Torah according to Halachim, say, well, I keep the Ten Commandments, it's not true. It is not true because first of all, they don't keep the entire ten. And even in keeping the, even if you honor, do you honor your father and mother? They mean it in a vague, general sense that we should show some respect. But there's specifics, there's particularities as to what that entails.
You're doing things that you don't have to do and not doing things that
exactly,
you have.
Good point. But even insofar as, let's the specific, where it says that you're not allowed to be a false witness. And let's say the person was scrupulous about that. He never testified falsely. I'm maintaining that that itself does not prove, because it encompasses much, much more. That's just the heading, the overall heading, that is to say that these 10 dibros, now let's get the correct word. Dibra is not the word for commandment. The word for commandment is mitzvah. So what is dibra then? I would suggest a dibra is a statement. These are the 10, but I don't like to use that word because it's not significant enough. People make statements. I would call it the 10 declarations. 10 declarations. Let's try and see then this concept, how all of the 613, I can't go through all 613, so we'll just do a few. For example, I just started with this one, that not to bear false witness. So the heading, you know, the major case would be where you have the full trappings, where you have a court and you're sworn in and you give testimony. But it applies to any situation in which a person deceives other people by virtue of his testimony. So as I said, if you fill out a form and you lie, you give false information. Now I'm talking about where it's a matter of significance, obviously. And because of that information, you manage to get people to do certain things.
But there are such loopholes to that.
Well, if it doesn't make any difference,
no,
that's something else. So the general rule should be that we should be careful. That lying per se is considered to be prohibited. Midvar sheker tirchak. Because that has a distorting effect upon the soul. So one should not engage in that. With children sometimes, it's a white lie, it's meaningless, and you play games with it, and so on and so forth. A lot of times
the famous thing that even God lies.
There are, like anything else, in Judaism, in and of itself, it's not an absolute evil. It is true that there are situations, well, for example, I mean, Shabbos, or mitzvos, absolutes, but there are situations that override it to save a life and so on and so forth. So lying is a very serious thing. Midvar sheker tirchak, a person should not lie. And sometimes a person lies just for the fun of it, even if you don't harm anybody among friends, you know, you exaggerate, whatever the case may be. And even if it doesn't lead to any practical result, it doesn't cost them any money. So you might say, what difference does it make? I had fun. I was, you know, you're telling a story, but the story could use some embellishment. So we all do that. For whatever reason, it's enjoyable. Because, whatever, it gives you a certain sense of importance and how people look at you and what happened to me in my day. So you exaggerate it, then you come out, look, the story looks better. Makes you wonder about all the things you read in the newspapers. There's always what actually happened and the embellishment. They want to sell newspapers. They don't want to communicate truth to you. They want to sell newspapers. So that you really shouldn't engage in that. Because what's the problem with that? The problem with lying is not just the practical result. That as a result of a lie, you're going to commit an injustice. That is certainly the case. That if you lie, as a result of this lie, the government gives you back money, which you're not entitled to, so that's really theft. You're stealing. But even if no harmful consequence comes from it, So I told the story, and I made it, I changed it around to make it juicier, and people enjoyed it more. So I didn't hurt anybody. Yeah, but you hurt yourself, because the distortion of reality, that element in a person which is committed to MS, to truth, it's a very, very significant thing, and it's easily broken down because there's always the temptation to alter the truth to obtain some emotional gratification. So therefore, a person should be careful about that. Okay? So now, that's a category. Not to testify falsely is a category. It's the heading of a category, and there are many, many laws that will fall into that category. Okay? So let's just go along with this a little bit. I'm going to give you one of the 613 commandments. Okay? We'll play a little game over here. It's a game. I don't know. Here's the game we're playing is called Name That Declaration. Lo tamar al dam reyecha. Do not stand by idly by the blood of your brother. Now that's not one of the ten. But therefore it has to fall into one of the ten. Think about it. Which one would you say it falls into? Right. That is in the Aseret HaDibros. Because, you see, now people who say they keep the Ten Commandments, but what about for us? If you're in a situation where another Jew is in danger and you could come to their aid, you have an obligation to do so. Failure to do so, where does that stem from? That's Lo Tirtzach. Thou shalt not kill. So now the Torah is concerned with all the different activities that could have an effect upon causing the death of another Jew. So Lo Tirtzach is the heading. That is to say that this is an absolute, that you're not allowed to murder. And so, the worst case, the worst expression of that is when you actively engage in the activity of being a murderer. But there's other ways you could do it. Other ways you could do it. And, maybe one of those ways is not taking care of your own health. Interesting connection over here. Maybe that too, maybe the obligation of taking care of one's health can trace itself back to the Aseret HaDibros, Lo Tirtzach, to the extent, because that's it, you're negligent of life. Now, Lo Tirtzach is the worst expression of being negligent of life, obviously. But there's many, many other forms, day-to-day forms, where people engage in reckless behaviors. Reckless behaviors, perhaps the violation there too, is the failure of Shmiras HaNefesh, the failure to preserve yourself, that too is a form of Lo Tirtzach. Let's take another mitzvah then. The concept is the same. Whether the preservation of life, that is to say the recognition of the Creator, that God is the Creator of life, and life was created for a purpose, and man's first obligation is to preserve it. Of course, just to preserve it in a purely biologically and physically is not enough, but that's first and foremost. And the severe prohibition of being reckless about it, of harming it, the ultimate expression is Lo Tirtzach, but there's many other forms. One second. As far as that's concerned, the obligation of preserving life, of course, that can be with your friend. Then it falls more directly into the Lo Tirtzach, but it applies to yourself as well. For example, a suicide is an expression of Lo Tirtzach. Someone who commits suicide is engaged in murder. That's murder. Murder of the self. But also then, there's many ways, there's forms of murder. Some people do it overtly. Other people do it it's interesting. There are many people that commit suicide in a different way. You read about it in the papers all the time. People that live a lifestyle that's very dangerous, mixing drugs and drinking, getting drunk, and so on and so forth, crazy behaviors, that they're what we would call self-destructive. We would refer, there are many people that are self-destructive. That fits in line with what the Rambam said. I mean, that's most of the harm we suffer is induced by ourselves. But that too is Lo Tirtzach. I mean, there's different ways in which you can achieve the objective. Some people, for whatever reasons, cannot do it. They've got to be passive murder. They can't do it overtly. But they express this, whatever the aggression is expressed, by adopting a certain form of behavior which is destructive of the self and can lead to suicide. It's a form of suicide. It's not conscious suicide, but it's unconscious suicide. Let's take the next one. Kashrut. Is kashrut to be found in the Aseret HaDibros? It says, Lo sachmot eishes reyecha. You shouldn't covet. The meaning, there's some basis for that conclusion. But the idea behind it was that the idea of kashrus is to restrain ourselves, that we shouldn't lead a lustful existence where we just pursue the instinctive and the lust. That's the lust. So a person who lusts after what other people have, or it could even be, so that's the same thing. It could be anything. It could be the neighbor's house, the neighbor's wife. So it's a sexual kind of thing. However, I agree with Jesse. I think it's more specifically included in Lo Tinuf. Lo Tinuf is talking about adultery, but it's not just adultery. It means to engage in uncontrolled sexual behavior, forbidden sexual behaviors. So basically, that's what the Rambam classifies the laws of kashrus together with the laws of forbidden sexual relations under the heading of Kedusha. That is to say that there's an objective over here, that kashrus really is intended to restrain oneself, to gratify one's instincts in an intelligent kind of a way, but not in a lustful kind of a way where you just give in and you live an instinctual existence. So the chief, what's the chief expression of the individual who lives for the hedonistic is the sexual, the sensual. The sexual is more powerful than the appetitive. It's the essence of not to covet your neighbor's wife is not a sexual prohibition. That's not because of the sexual. That's a different type of a thing. That's because of envy. That's the factor of envy, where it's not because you have the sexual need. It's simply because it's the idea that the other person has it. That I feel jealous. That why should you're living in terms of the comparison. You compare. We discussed that yesterday. That is to say, a person can be perfectly happy with what he has. This is the irony of human existence. He can have a nice home, he can have a car, etc., and he's very happy with it until suddenly his best friend becomes wealthy and he visits him in this mansion and he's got this beautiful house with this beautiful car, and suddenly his own house is not satisfying anymore. So that's the concept of lusting. That is to say, to base, you're not satisfied anymore with what you have because somebody else has something better. To base your desires, your sense of what is appropriate for you is not based upon what you need, but now you're living in accordance with envy, the envy principle. That's why I agree that's not kashrut. That the essence of kashrut is nothing to do with comparison to others. It has to do with how you relate to your own instinctual makeup. Now we're asking the question, what about the mitzvah of tshuva? Is that included in the Aseret Dibros? If so, which one specifically, which one of the 10? Yeah, I think the answer to the question of tshuva would be Anochi Hashem Elokecha, because as we say, that's the ultimate obligation is to live in the presence of Hashem, to recognize Hashem, and every sin takes a person, like the Rambam says, to be mitzvadeh, to confess the sins that he did b'fnei Hashem. So the essence of sin, of course, there's other factors, it's being pointed out. There's no question that it involves idolatrous notions. There's no question about that. But if we're talking about the Dibra, which most directly, specifically, includes this, which heading, you have to put it in one of the 10 boxes, seems to me that the whole essence of tshuva is because tshuva is a breakdown of Anochi Hashem Elokecha.
I think it's a breakdown of Lo
Yilecha. As far as Lo Yilecha, it's not the same, because a person sinned because he had a desire. He had a desire. And he was overcome by temptation. So he didn't want to, he didn't embrace idolatry. He would never go near idolatry.
He certainly did.
Not directly. Under idolatry you have going to a fortune teller, soothsayers, and superstitions, and all red bindles, etc., etc., etc. That's idolatry. That's not Anochi Hashem Elokecha, even though idolatry is connected. That's there, you're correct. So you have to be, it's got to be more specific. So that if you want to say that if you worship the Almighty Dollar, that's also idolatry, in a sense, but not directly. The Torah does not consider greed to be the same thing, although one could lead to another. Allison is asking a very good question now. Questions being raised, there's a mitzvah in Devarim about Shiluach HaKan. That is to say, when you encounter a chick, the mother with its chicks nesting on the, and so forth, and you want to take the chicks, so Shaleh, you have to send away the mother. And then you can take, and that's a very important mitzvah, by the way, because that's one of the, besides Kibud Av V'Em, honoring one's parents, that is a mitzvah where the Torah mentions the reward, you'll have Arichas Yamim, you have a long life, and so on. So the question's being raised, which one of the 10 does this fit into? We have a number of different answers here. Yeah. No, but she's saying specifically. You can, of course, everything is an Ochei Shem Elokech in that sense, but then it's not specific. We're trying to deal with the substance of the particular. So, Anochei Hashem, I am the Lord your God. So Yirina means, because part of that obligation is to imitate the ways of God. That is part of that. That's a very good point. Mahu afata. So it's not enough. That's a beautiful illustration of the point, by the way. The point that's being made by Yirina is a very valid point, whether we accept it in this case or not, with regard to the Shiloh HaKan. But what she's saying is, and it illustrates the point beautifully, Anochi Hashem Elokecha is the major heading, which means to recognize and to acknowledge. The Rambam uses, the Ramban, a beautiful expression, Neda V'Namin, to know and believe. That's what I discussed this past Shabbos, was the Dvar Torah. How could he say that? If you know, you don't believe. You don't have to believe. And if you believe, then you don't know. You can't have the two. What does he mean by that? But nevertheless, it doesn't just mean that. It means all the implications of that. So part of the implication is that Anochi Hashem Elokecha, I am the ultimate reality. I am your God. So what does it mean? How am I your God? When you imitate my ways. So if a person, that's beautiful, the practice of compassion, to practice compassion is one of the 10 dibros. And what is the dibra? Because of Anochi Hashem Elokecha. And since Anochi Hashem, since I am the Lord your God, and since I am the ultimate reality, if you accept that, and my ways, so to speak, the way they manifest, are ways of compassion, so afata, then you too have to be compassionate. So thus, the mitzvah of Shiluach HaKan is founded in compassion. There's a machlokus between the Rambam and the Ramban as to whether the ultimate cause is because God cares about the pain of the bird, or that's the Rambam. The Ramban says, no, that's not the reason for it, but rather it's for us, that we should inculcate ourselves with the midah of rachamim. So it's all based upon rachamim. So where is rachamim? Where is mercy, compassion found? Is that part of the Asaras HaDibros? So Irina is suggesting, yes, even though we don't find any specific dibro which says, thou shalt be compassionate, why not? Compassion is the foundation of Judaism. But it's already there. Because our compassion is not humanitarian feelings, it's not emotions, it's purely because of our recognition of Hashem. If a person denies God, a person doesn't believe in God, but he's a humanitarian, he has a certain feeling for people, and he does compassionate things. That is not Kedusha, that's not the sanctification, that's not the compassion we're talking about. Compassion is a fundamental of Judaism. It's one of the three things that identifies a Jew. Rachmanim, that the Jewish people are Rachmanim, they're merciful, Baishanim, they're modest, certain modesty, V'gomle chasadim, and they're gomel, they're engaged in actions of kindness, kind actions. So where is that found in the Asaras HaDibros? So the answer is being suggested. Oh no, that's part of Anochi Hashem Elokecha. If you don't practice compassion, if it doesn't express itself in deeds, then you don't have God. There's no God. Then it means to say that it's just an empty declaration, and it doesn't express itself in activities. If it doesn't express itself in those activities which reflect this belief, then you don't believe in God. It's true that in doing so, it also partakes to a certain extent of the kibud av ve'eim, insofar as there is a recognition of the parental relationship. So I'm not saying that it's going to be exclusively one. That is, you'll find a mitzvah which will partake of one, may partake of a few others, in certain, because there's many aspects of the mitzvah. But what's the essential one? In essence, it's not. In other words, the mitzvah of Shiluach HaKan, in essence, in my opinion, in essence, is not because of Kibud Av V'Aim, although it contributes and it's connected. But
the recognition of the Creator.
The most fundamental, that's indirect. Mm-hmm. Well, Kibud Av V'Aim, so there's also an Ochei Hashem Elokecha. You could say that too. You're right. I mean, they overlap. There's definitely an overlapping, but there's a specification.
Let's say,
questions being raised that, pursuing this line, that maybe really it falls under Kibud Av V'Aim, that what about, the eggs, where another, not the mother, but whatever, the mother died and some other bird is sitting on it. Would the requirement be the same then? Would I then be permitted to take it away, or would I have to send it away? Or in the case of penguins, perhaps, which I'm not familiar with, but the father does, do you? In my opinion, it would be the same. It would be the same thing, because the whole essence is the compassion, not to inflict pain and suffering on even the animal world, because that would break down the category of compassion. But it's not based, we don't have to do an investigation of the biological, this is the father, that's the technically speaking who the father is. Truth of the matter is that there really isn't, the whole concept of fatherhood, of parenthood, doesn't really exist in the animal world. It's just an instinctual. So that whatever animal is function, it's a functional phenomenon. Whatever animal is in that role, so that the animal would suffer the pain, then it would be prohibited. No one does an inquiry as to who the actual parent was. As far as lo tevash el gedi b'chalev imo, as far as basa b'chalev, where the Rambam explains that's connected to the principle of compassion, because it's a distancing that you shouldn't come to slaughter both the mother and the child on the same day, and then if you do that, that is true. But if you were to ask me where I would classify it in the Aseres HaDibros, it would be challenging. Because you might say in the same category as Shiluach HaKan, same idea. But it seems to me, you see, it becomes very complicated. That's true, that's one of the aspects, but essentially it falls under the rules of forbidden foods. So it's under the system. The Torah created a system of kashrut. The primary idea of the system of kashrut is to control one's lust. So then the Torah tacked on to that certain other things to... Now the question is, what should be permitted, what should be prohibited? Because you can set up, the prohibitions, the limited can be arbitrary. So they're not arbitrary, they will also include the element of compassion. That's tacked on. But I would take meat and milk, forbidden meat and milk and all of that, I'd put it in the category of kashrut, and I'd put it under the heading of lotinuf. Even though it does partake of these elements as well. It gets very complex. We have another category of questions being raised. The particular mitzvah in the Torah is in warfare, you can't cut down a fruit-bearing tree. And from there it extends to destruction of valuables, pretty much. Destruction of valuables, that's a very good question. That is baltashkos, what we call baltashkos, and I guess to a large extent we do it, even though we not be in violation, we have extra food and then we throw it out. I'm not saying you're violating it, because it's only baltashkos when you have a use for it. But when you have no, like people break dishes, get angry, I mean, things like that, to destroy property is considered, it's a biblical commandment. And just to take stuff and throw it in the garbage is prohibition. If it's useful stuff, you could give it to the poor, somebody could use it, and so on and so forth. Obviously, you may not always be able to do that, so after a kiddush or at the end of Shabbos, you have leftover food, you have nothing to do with it, you throw it out, then you're not in violation. Even though theoretically it could be used. I mean where something could really be used. Where it's being suggested that, as we're in accordance with our principle, that every mitzvah falls into one of the headings. Of course, it requires sometimes a little bit of creativity over here. It's not maybe immediately apparent, but I do want to consider the idea of Shabbos. Jesse is suggesting that Shabbos is part of the concept of Shabbos is creation from nothing, which means the eternity of Hashem, and the fact that everything that we experience is from Hashem, but we don't have true bialus, we don't have true ownership. That's the whole idea of karban, that it's a recognition and an acknowledgement that everything comes from Hashem, and we don't even have, we're just custodians, we're temporary custodians in that sense, that we don't, nothing is coming to us. And therefore, we have to treat everything. We have a right. There's a right of usage. Interestingly enough, I would even say, let me, before we conclude this point, what about bracha? What about making a bracha before you eat? Which one would that fall into? Now, you'll tell me, well, that's a rabbinic enactment. But every rabbinic has to be in line with a dioraisa, and every dioraisa must fit into the one of the ten. What about making a bracha before you eat? It's being suggested that this falls under the heading of theft. The Rambam does use that term.
Of course he does.
On the surface, one can say that it has to do with what seems like theft, superficially. That is, the Rambam says that whoever eats food, partakes of God's creation, and doesn't make a bracha, it's akin to me'ila. Me'ila is a form of theft. That is, it's like misappropriation of that which is hegdish. And that is from the Beis HaMikdash. If a person takes something from the Beis HaMikdash and uses it for his own purposes, it's called Me'ila. So you'd say, well, then it's theft. You're stealing from God. I don't accept that. I see the point, but I don't accept it. I'll tell you why. The category of theft in the Aseres HaDibros has to do, first of all, with kidnapping, with kidnapping another human being. But it also is subsumed under that as every other form of monetary damage, the rights. It's not murder. Murder is a different, interrelated, obviously, but it's a different expression. Here, it's where you don't kill the person, but you interfere with the expression of his rights. Of course, one could argue if you kidnap an individual and sell him as a slave, so that's tantamount to death. That's true, it's tantamount, but it's a different category. It's a different way of doing it. So therefore, any way in which you diminish his rights in terms of property, his rights of ownership, and so on and so forth. Let me ask you this question then. What about returning lost objects? The prohibition, there's a prohibition, by the way. When you encounter a lost object, this is a very serious thing. I don't think people give it enough attention. That is to say, a person's attitude towards kashrut, you know, you're not buying a product, and maybe it's not kosher. And also, if you're walking down the street or you're driving, you see an object, and you keep going, you know, like a person does not have the same religious emotion that maybe... It's not just that you have an obligation to return it. You're not allowed to walk away from it. It's a negative and it's a positive. So I go back there, pair of gloves, good gloves. And I couldn't... How did it get there? Two gloves, like, you know, nice winter gloves. And it didn't have anybody's name in it, but the brand was, you know, if anybody knew the brand, the person could tell you what the brand was and the color. So then I brought it to the yeshiva and I asked the fellas if there's any lost and found, whatever it is, and just in case, I don't know, there's not to be a yeshiva guy. Yeah. I would say that which one of the ten, Sarah said the answer, that falls into the category thou shalt not steal. That is to say, even though you're not stealing, you didn't steal, but the general... The ultimate heading is to take away the person's monetary. Here, but there's many, many obligations that devolve upon us because of concern for somebody else's monetary rights. So the failure, just like the failure to help a person implicates you in murder if he dies, so too the failure to return implicates you. So it's like theft. I mean, it causes him to lose money. Causing him to lose money. Theft means to cause a fellow Jew to lose money. So if you don't return what you could have returned, you're causing him to lose money. That is not the idea in saying a blessing when it's like theft. It's not the same thing. You don't steal from God in that way. It's a completely different concept. But rather, it is rooted in that recognition that everything is from Hashem, and that's Shabbos. Shabbos means that the Shabbos is the man. Shabbos means that it's a recognition of creation from nothing and that everything is from Hashem. All the benefit we have is from Hashem. And if you don't say a bracha, you're making it's like mine. It's my world. I do what I want. I don't have to acknowledge the Creator. Of course it has to do with Anochi Hashem Elokecha, but that's an overlap. That's an override. The idea of theft over here means that since it's not your food, it's a different kind of theft. It's not theft where you're taking away from somebody else. It means to say you're not entitled to it. So there's two aspects in theft. One is I'm taking away from you. The other one, I'm not entitled to it. Meaning to say that this is an unauthorized eating.
You know, this is like a
I'm not entitled to it. What? By the way, just tangentially, conservative and reform would not engage in this because we're showing the integrity, the interconnectedness of the entire Torah. They want to choose and select. They want to say, thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself. That's Judaism. But kashrut is not.
No, but you're saying it's...
Well, we're saying it's all interconnected. They're separate mitzvos. But the idea that the mitzvos line up, that there's general headings of the mitzvos, that makes perfect sense. You see, I have to say that. In terms of the philosophical category of the mitzvah, clearly, to not stand idly by the blood of your brother is clearly ritzicha. That's ritzicha. That's true. It's a truism. So, to the contrary, what we're doing is we're showing that this idea, when people say, I keep the Ten Commandments, that's it, that's false. That's absolute checker. If you keep the Ten, then you've got to keep the 613, because everything is an expression, so to speak. The ten dibro, that's why it's dibro. It's a statement, it's a declaration, it's a category. It's a philosophical category, which you must accept the category. Once you accept the category, and then you recognize, I'll tell you what the practical significance of this is. I'll tell you the practical significance of this is. If you don't take this approach, so then people are likely not to take the obligation of returning a lost object seriously. Because in a society we live in, most people look at that as being, well, it's a nice thing, a nice guy, you're a nice person, thank you. If somebody bothered to pick up my wallet and to look it up and give me a call and return it, nice person. But you may be busy. The average individual, I couldn't do it, I was busy, this and that. This person would never steal. So I couldn't do it. I'm not saying, I regret it. I wish I could do it, but I'm too busy. But if you connect it to the Aseret HaDibros, and you take seriously Lo Tignov and the philosophical concept behind Lo Tignov, that it's not limited just to an act of theft, which I would never steal, or you wouldn't steal. But do you respect the monetary rights of your fellow Jew? And would you ever put yourself in a position where you're responsible for his loss of money? That's the idea. The average person, a good citizen, doesn't steal, but he doesn't return objects either. A perfected individual looks at it from the perspective of being concerned about the monetary rights of his fellow Jew. That person is going to look at the obligation to return the object the same way. He's going to be looking at that just as carefully as he looks at the piece of lettuce to find the bugs in it. So I would say the way we're looking at it, of course I stand to be corrected. You could show me that analytically that it should be in a different category. But the basic thrust of this, and by the way, it's not a game. This is very, very serious. Because, as I've just pointed out, our relationship to particular mitzvos, then we've been affected by the society in which we live. And then generally speaking, religious people tend to take certain things much more seriously. Like I said, the ritualistic and the kashrut, and so people who are extremely stringent and machmir in those areas, yet when it comes to ethics and behavior and hurting other people and compassion, don't necessarily look at it the same way. And even ordinary people that would never dream of stealing, but they see a lost object, they don't have the same reaction.
How come philosophical?
In terms of returning the lost object, it's not just that the act of returning, per se, in and of itself, is a great thing to do. The assumption is that this is something which is useful, that this is something which the person needs, values, whatever the case may be, for the way they live their life. Let's say purely philosophically. There's a difference between the halachic and the philosophical. And that is to say that somebody, let's say it's a Gentile, whatever it is, a person lives like an animalistic kind of life, and he loses some kind of machine, whatever, a player which he uses for pornography and stuff like that. Or to return a camera to someone who's involved in child porn. Okay, that's that. So you returned it because after return. So did you do it? That's evil to do a thing like that. I'm just using that as an illustration. So the idea of returning presupposes a certain context that decent people need these objects for decent purposes. But Russia, a Nazi, I won't return to him. He has no rights. Why would I strengthen him? To the contrary. So you have to use seichel. You can't say it's an absolute. That just the return is an absolute good, no matter what you return. You return the needle to the drug addict. Wow. Because he owns it. What did you achieve? So now he can go on shooting himself up. That's absurd. So, okay, now it's just a question of who determines and how do we determine. But you have to realize that the act of returning in the context in which it's a benefit is a big mitzvah for us to do. And then it would fall under the heading of a form of theft to avoid doing.
You also have to consider.
There is. You can see the theft over here. Because if that happens, you sometimes feel funny that it doesn't belong to me, I have no right to this, it's not my money, you see the theft thing? But sometimes the mind will tell you, but the Torah demands that we subordinate our emotions to our halachic system. That even if I don't feel that way, sometimes you have a right to take it. A person, in terms of improving themselves, should look at those areas, and there's many, where your emotions are not in line with the halacha, with the common emotion too, everybody feels this way. For example, interestingly enough, sometimes the requirements of the Torah. Here's interesting. Here's a perfect one. Answer this question. Not now. Write up an essay. Why is it that if for whatever reason you pass up an object on the street, you don't feel guilty about that? But if the clerk made a mistake and you got the change and the halacha says you can keep it, you do feel guilty about that. It shows you that if you're functioning by emotion, you're involved in a world of contradiction.
I tell you how far
you're involved in a world of contradiction.